11.
Captain Ravel!
The soldier was one of those hand-picked by the Archon to be in on some part of the deception. He feigned surprise as Locke appeared on the Red Messenger's deck, followed by Jean, Caldris, and the two ex-prisoners. The launch full of men was just butting up against the ship's starboard side.
"I didn't expect you back this evening, sir." "Sir, what's going on?"
"I have reached a decision," said Locke, approaching the soldier. "This ship is too fine a thing for the Archon to have, so I am relieving him of its care and taking it to sea."
"Now, hold on! Hold on, sir! That's not funny!"
"Depends on where you're standing," said Locke.
He stepped up and delivered a feigned punch to the soldier's stomach.
"Depends on if you're standing."
By arrangement, the man did a very credible impression of having received a devastating blow and fell backward to the deck, writhing. Locke grinned. Let his new crew whisper of that amongst themselves. The crew in question had just started to come up the boarding nets on the starboard side. Locke relieved the soldier of his sword, buckler, and knives, then joined Jean and Caldris at the rail to help the men up.
"What's to be done with the launch, Captain?"
Jabril said as he came over the side.
"It's too damn big to carry with us on this little bitch," said Locke.
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the subdued guard. "We'll set him adrift in it. Jerome?"
"Aye, sir," said Jean.
"Get everyone up and muster all hands at the waist. Master Caldris, you know the vessel best for now. Give us lights."
Caldris fetched alchemical lamps from a locker near the wheel, and with Locke's help, he hung them about the deck until they had more than enough soft golden light to work by. Jean produced his little whistle and blew three short blasts. In moments, he had the crew herded into the middle of the ship's waist, before the mainmast. Before them all, Locke stood, stripped off his Ferrari officer's coat, and pitched it over the side. They applauded.
"Now, we must have haste without carelessness," he said. "Those of you that do not believe yourselves fit for work, hands up. No shame, lads."
Locke counted 9 hands. Most of the men who raised them were visibly aged, or far too slender for good health, and Locke nodded.
"We hold no grudge for your honesty. You'll take up your share of work once you're fit again. For now, find a spot on the main deck below or beneath the forecastle. There's mats and canvas in the main hold. You may sleep or watch the fun as you see fit. Now, can anyone among you claim to be any sort of cook?"
One of the men standing behind Jabril raised a hand.
"Good. When the anchor's up, get below and have a look at the stores. We've a brick firebox at the forecastle, plus an alchemical stone and a cauldron. We'll want a hell of a meal once we're out past the glass reefs, so show some initiative and tap a cask of ale."
The men began cheering at that, and Jean blew his whistle to quiet them down.
"Come now!"
Locke pointed to the darkness of the Elderglass Island looming behind them. "The Sword Marina's just the other side of that island, and we're not away yet. Jerome, capstan bars and stand by to haul up anchor. Jabril, fetch rope from Caldris and help me with this fellow." Together, Locke and Jabril hoisted the incapacitated soldier to his feet. Locke tied a loose but very convincing knot around his hands with a scrap of rope provided by Caldris. Once they were gone, the man could work himself free in minutes.
"Don't kill me, Captain, please," the soldier muttered.
"I would never," said Locke. "I need you to carry a message to the Archon on my behalf. Tell him that he may kiss Orin Ravel's ass, that my commission is herewith resigned, and that the only flag his pretty ship will fly from now on is red."
Locke and Jabril hoisted the man over the side of the entry port and dropped him the 9 feet into the bottom of the launch. He yelped in, no doubt genuine, pain, and rolled over, but seemed otherwise okay.
"Use those exact words!" Locke cried, and Jabril laughed. "Now, Master Caldris, we shall make for sea."
"Very good, Captain Ravel!"
Caldris collared the 4 men nearest to him and began leading them below. Under his guidance, they would keep the anchor cable moving smoothly toward its tier on the orlop.
"Jerome," said Locke, "hands to the capstan to raise anchor."
Locke and Jibril joined all the remaining able-bodied members of the crew at the capstan, where the last of the heavy wooden bars were being slid into their apertures. Jean blew on his whistle, and the men crammed together shoulder to shoulder on the bars.
"Raise anchor! Step and on! Step and on! Push it hard! She'll be up ere long!"
Jean chanted at the top of his lungs, giving them a cadence to stamp and shove by. The men strained at the capstan, many of them weaker than they would have liked or admitted, but the mechanism began to turn, and the smell of wet cable filled the air.
"Heave and up! Heave and up! Drop the anchor and we'll all be fucked!"
Soon enough they managed to heave the anchor up out of the water, and Jean sent a party forward to the starboard bow to secure it. Most of the men stepped away from the capstan, groaning and stretching, and Locke smiled. Even his old injuries still felt good after the exercise.
"Now," he shouted, "who among you sailed this ship when she was the Fortunate Venture? Step aside."
14 men, including Jibril, separated themselves from the others.
"And who among you were fair topmen?"
That got him 7 raised hands, good enough for the time being.
"Any of you not familiar with this ship, nonetheless comfortable up above?"
4 men stepped forward, and Locke nodded.
"Good lads. You know where you'll be then."
He grabbed one of the non-top men by the shoulder and steered him toward the bow.
"Forward watch. Let me know if anything untoward pops up in front of us."
He grabbed another man and pointed to the mainmast.
"Get a glass from Caldris. You'll be masthead watch for now. Don't look at me like that. You won't be fucking with the rigging. Just sit still and stay awake." "Master Caldris," he bellowed, noting that the sailing master was back on deck. "Southeast by east through the reef passage called Underglass."
"Aye, sir, Underglass. I know the very one."
Caldris, of course, had plotted their course through the glass reefs in advance, and carefully instructed Locke in the orders to give until they were out of sight of Tal Vahrar.
"Southeast by east!"
Jean gestured at the 11 men who'd volunteered for duty up on the heights of the yardarms, where the furled sails waited, hanging in the moonlight like the thin cocoons of vast insects.
"Hands aloft to loose topsails and gallants! On the word, mind you!" "Master Caldris," shouted Locke, unable to disguise his mirth, "now we shall see if you know your business."
The Red Messenger moved south under topsails and topgallants, making fair use of the stiff breeze blowing west off the mainland. Her bow sliced smoothly through the calm, dark waters, and the deck beneath their feet heeled only the tiniest bit to starboard. It was a good start, thought Locke. A good start to a mad venture. When he had settled most of his crew in temporary positions, he stole a few minutes at the taffrail, watching the reflections of 2 moons in the gentle ripple of their wake.
"You're enjoying the hell out of yourself, Captain Ravel."
Jean stepped up to the taffrail beside him. The 2 thieves shook hands and grinned at one another.
"I suppose I am," Locke whispered. "I suppose this is the most lunatic thing we've ever done, and so we're entitled to bloody well enjoy ourselves."
"Crew seems to have bought the act for now."
"Well, they're still fresh from the vault, tired, underfed, excited. We'll see how sharp they are when they've had a few days of food and exercise. Gods, at least I didn't call anything by the wrong name."
"Hard to believe we're actually doing this."
"I know. Barely seems real yet.
Captain Ravel, First Mate Valora. Hell, you've got it easy. I've got to get used to people calling me Orin. You get to stay a Jerome."
"I saw little sense in making things harder for myself. I've got you to do that for me."
"Careful now. I can order you whipped at the rail."
"Ah,
A navy captain, maybe. A pirate first mate doesn't have to stand for that. Jean sighed. You think we'll ever see land again? I damn well mean to, said Locke. We've got pirates to piss off, a happy return to arrange, Stragos to humble, antidotes to find, and Requin to rob blind. 2 months at sea, and I may even begin to have the faintest notion how. They stared for a while at Tal'Varar sliding away behind them, at the aura of the golden steps and the torch glow of the Sin Spire slowly vanishing behind the darker mass of the city's southwestern crescent. Then they were passing through the navigational channel in the glass reefs, away to the Sea of Brass, away to danger and piracy, away to find war and bring it back for the Archon's convenience. 12.
Sail ahoy! Sail 2 points off the larboard bow!
The cry filtered down from above on the third morning of their voyage south. Locke sat in his cabin, regarding his blurry reflection in the dented little mirror he'd packed in his chest. Before departure, he'd used a bit of alchemy from his disguise kit to restore his hair to its natural colour, and now a fine shadow in much the same shade was appearing on his cheeks. He wasn't yet sure if he'd shave it, but with a shout from above, his concern for his beard vanished. In a moment he was out of the cabin, up the awkward steps of the dim companionway, and into the bright light of morning on the quarterdeck. A haze of high white clouds veiled the blue sky, like wisps of tobacco smoke that had drifted far from the pipes of their progenitors. They'd had the wind on their larboard beam since reaching open sea, and the Red Messenger was heeled over slightly to starboard. The constant swaying and creaking and deck slanting were utterly alien to Locke, who'd been confined to a cabin by infirmity on his last and only previous sea voyage. He flattered himself that the trained agility of a thief went some way toward feigning sea legs, but he avoided scampering around too much just in case. At least he appeared to be immune to seasickness this time out, and for that he thanked the crooked warden fervently. Many aboard had not been so lucky.
"What passes, Master Caldris?"
"Compliments of a fine morning, Captain, and the masthead watch says we got white canvas 2 points off the larboard bow."
Caldris had the wheel to himself this morning, and he drew light puffs from a cheap sheaf of cut-rate tobacco that stank like sulphur. Locke wrinkled his nose. Sighing inwardly and stepping with as much care as he could manage, Locke brought out his seeing-glass and hurried forward, up the forecastle and to the rail on the larboard bow. Yes, there it was, hull down, a minute speck of white, barely visible above the dark blue of the distant horizon. When he returned to the quarter-deck, Jibril and several other sailors were lounging around, waiting for his verdict.
"Do we give her the eyeball, Captain?"
Jibril seemed merely expectant, but the men behind him looked downright eager.
"Looking for an early taste of those equal shares, eh?"
Locke feigned deep consideration, turning toward Caldris long enough to catch the sailing master's private signal for an emphatic no. As Locke had expected, and he could give legitimate reasons without prompting.
"Can't do it, lads. You know better than that. We've not yet begun to set our own ship to rights. Little sense in taking a fight to someone else's. A quarter of us are still unfit for work, let alone battle. We've got fresh food, a clean ship, and all the time in the world. Better chances will come. Hold course, Master Caldris."
"Hold course, aye."
Jibril accepted this. Locke was discovering that the man had a solid core of sense and a fair knowledge of nearly every aspect of shipboard life, which made him Locke's superior in that wise. He was a fine mate, another bit of good fortune to be grateful for. The men behind Jibril now, Locke instinctively knew they needed some occupying task to help mitigate their disappointment.
"Straver," he said to the youngest, "heave the log aft. Mal, you mind the minute glass. Report to Master Caldris. Jibril, you know how to use a recurved bow?"
"Aye, Captain. Short bow, recurved, long bow. Decent aim with any.
I've got 10 of them in a locker down in the aft hold.
Should be easy to find. Couple hundred arrows, too. Rig up some archery butts with canvas and straw. Mount them at the bow so nobody gets an unpleasant surprise in the arse. Start sharpening up the lads in groups, every day when the weather allows. Time comes to finally pay a visit to another ship. I'll want good archers in the tops.
Fine idea, Captain.
That at least seemed to restore excitement to the sailors who were still milling near the quarterdeck. Most of them followed Jibril down a hatchway to the main deck. Their interest in the matter gave Locke a further thought.
Master Valora!
Jean was with Merlon, their cook, scrutinizing something at the little brick firebox abutting the forecastle. He waved an acknowledgement of Locke's shout.
By sunset, I want to know that every man aboard knows where all the weapons lockers are. Make sure of it yourself.
Jean nodded and returned to whatever he was doing. By Locke's reckoning, the idea that Captain Ravel wanted every man to be comfortable with the ship's weapons, aside from the bows, there were hatchets, sabers, clubs, and a few polearms, would be far better for morale than the thought that he would prefer keeping them locked up or hidden.
Well done, said Caldris quietly.
Mal watched the last few grains in the minute glass bolted to the mainmast run out, then turned aft and shouted,
Hold the line!
7.5 knots,
Strever hollered a moment later.
7.5, said Caldris. Very well. We've been making that more or less steady since we left Verar. A good run.
Locke snuck a glance at the pegs sunk into the holes on Caldris' navigational board and the compass in the binnacle, which showed them on a heading just a hair's breadth west of due south.
A fine piece if it holds,
muttered Caldris around his cigar.
Puts us in the ghost winds maybe 2 weeks from today. Don't know about the captain, but getting a few days ahead of schedule makes me very bloody comfortable.
And will it hold? Locke spoke as softly as he could without whispering into the sailing master's ear.
Good question. Summer's end's an odd time on the Sea of Brass. We got storms out there somewhere. I can feel it in my bones. They're a ways off. But they're waiting.
Oh, splendid.
We'll make do, Captain.
Caldris briefly removed his cigar, spat something brown at the deck, and returned it to between his teeth.
Fact is, we're doing just fine, thank the Lord of the Grasping Waters.
13.
Ilim Jibril, get him right in the fucking heart.
Jibril stood amidships, facing a frock coat, donated from Locke's chest, nailed to a wide board and propped up against the mainmast, about 30 feet away. Both of his feet touched a crudely chalked line on the deck planks. In his right hand was a throwing knife, and in his left was a full wine bottle, by the rules of the game. The sailor who'd been shouting encouragement burped loudly and started stomping the deck. The circle of men around Jibril picked up the rhythm and began clapping and chanting, slowly at first, then faster and faster.
Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop.
Jibril flexed for the crowd, wound up, and flung the knife. It struck dead center in the coat, and up went a cheer that quickly turned to howls. Jibril had sloshed some of the wine out of the bottle.
"Dumb it!"
he cried.
"Wine waster!"
shouted one of the men gathered around him, with the fervour of a priest decrying the worst sort of blasphemy.
"Pay the penalty and put it where it belongs!"
"Hey, at least I hit the coat," said Jibril with a grin. "You nearly killed someone on the quarter-deck with your throw!"
"Pay the price! Pay the price! Pay the price!" chanted the crowd. Jibril put the bottle to his lips, tipped it all the way up, and began to guzzle it in one go. The chanting rose in volume and tempo as the amount of wine in the bottle sank. Jibril's neck and jaw muscles strained mightily, and he raised his free hand high into the air as he sucked the last of the dark red stuff down. The crowd applauded. Jibril pulled the bottle from his lips, lowered his head, and sprayed a mouthful of wine all over the man closest to him.
"Oh, no!" he cried. "I spilled a drop.
My turn, said the drenched sailor. I'm going to lose on purpose and spill a drop right back, mate.
Locke and Caldris watched from the starboard rail of the quarterdeck. Caldris was taking a rare break from the wheel. Jean currently had it. They were sailing along in a calm, muggy dusk, just pleasant enough for Caldris to separate himself from the ship's precious helm by half a dozen paces.
This was a good idea, said Locke.
Poor bastards have been under the boot for so long, they deserve a good debauch.
Caldris was smoking a pale blue ceramic pipe, the finest and most delicate thing Locke had ever seen in his hands, and his face was lit by the soft glow of embers. At Caldris' suggestion, Locke had had large quantities of wine and beer. The Red Messenger was amply provisioned with both, and for a crew twice this size, hauled up on deck, and he'd offered a choice of indulgences to every man on board. A double ration of fresh roasted pork, courtesy of the small but well-larded pig they'd brought with them, for those who would stay sober and on watch, and a drunken party for those who wouldn't. Caldris, Jean, and Locke were sober, of course, along with four hands who'd chosen the pork.
"It's things like this that makes a ship seem like home," said Caldris. "Help you forget what a load of tedious old shit life out here can be."
"It's not so bad," said Locke, a bit wistfully.
"Aye," says the captain of the fucking ship on a night sent by the gods.
He drew smoke and blew it out over the rail.
"Well, if we can arrange a few more nights like this, it'll be bloody grand. Quiet moments are worth more than whips and manacles for discipline, mark my words."
Locke gazed out across the black waves and was startled to see a pale white-green shape, glowing like an alchemical lantern, leap up from the waves and splash back down a few seconds later. The arc of its passage left an iridescent afterimage when he blinked.
"Gods," he said, "what the hell is that?"
There was a fountain of the things now, about 100 yards from the ship. They flew silently after one another, appearing and disappearing above the surf, casting their ghostly light on black water that returned it like a mirror.
"You really are new to these waters," said Caldris. "Those are flit wraiths, Costa. South of Tal Vahrah, you see 'em all about. Sometimes in great schools or arches leaping over the water, over ships. They've been known to follow us about, but only after dark, mind you."
"Are they some kind of fish?"
"Nobody rightly knows," said Caldris. "Flit wraiths can't be caught. They can't be touched, as I hear it. They fly right through nets like they was ghosts. Maybe they are."
"Eerie," said Locke.
"You get used to 'em after a few years," said Caldris.
He drew smoke from his pipe, and the orange glow strengthened momentarily.
"The Sea of Brass is a damned strange place, Costa. Some say it's haunted by the Eldrin. Most say it's just plain haunted. I've seen things. St. Corella's fire burning blue and red on the yardarms, scaring the piss out of the top watch. I sailed over seas like glass and seen a city once. Down below, not kidding, walls and towers, white stone, plain as day, right beneath our hull, in waters that our charts put at 1,000 fathoms. Real as my nose it was, then gone."
"Eh," said Locke, smiling. "You're pretty good at this. You don't have to toy with me, Caldris."
"I'm not toying with you one bit, Costa."
Caldris frowned, and his face took on a sinister cast in the pipe light.
"I'm telling you what to expect. Flit wraiths is just the beginning. Hell, flit wraiths is almost friendly. There's things out there even I have trouble believing. And there's places no sensible ship's master will ever go. Places that are wrong somehow. Places that wait for you."
"Ah," said Locke, recalling his desperate early years in the old and rotten places of Camor, and a thousand looming broken buildings that had seemed to wait in darkness to swallow small children. Now there I grasp your meaning.
The Ghostwind Isles, said Caldras. Well, they're the worst of all. In fact, there's only 8 or 9 islands human beings have actually set foot on and come back to tell about it. But gods know how many more are hiding down there, under the fogs, or what the fuck's on 'em.
He paused before continuing.
You ever hear of the 3 settlements of the Ghost Winds?
I don't think so, said Locke.
Well, Caldras took another long puff on his pipe. Originally, there was 3. Settlers out of Talvarar touched there about 100 years ago. Founded Port Prodigal, Montier, and Hope of Silver. Port Prodigal's still there, of course. Only 1 left. Montier was doing well until the war against the Free Armada. Prodigal's tucked well back in a fine defensive position. Montier wasn't. After we did for their fleet, we paid a visit. Burnt their fishing boats, poisoned their wells, sank their docks. Torched everything standing, then torched the ashes. Might as well have just rubbed the name Montier off the map. Place ain't worth resettling.
And Hope of Silver?
Hope of Silver? Said Caldras, lowering his voice to a whisper. 50 years ago, Hope of Silver was larger than Port Prodigal, on a different island, farther west, thriving. That silver wasn't just a hope. 300 families, give or take. Whatever happened, happened in 1 night. Those 300 families just gone.
Gone?
Gone. Vanished. Not a body to be found. Not a bone for birds to pick at. Something came down from those hills, out of that fog above the jungle, and gods know what it was, but it took 'em all.
Merciful hells.
If only, said Caldras. A ship or two poked around after it happened. They found 1 ship from Hope of Silver itself, drifting offshore, like it had put out in a real hurry. On it they found the only bodies left from the whole mess. A few sailors, all the way up the masts, up at the very tops. Caldras sighed. They'd lashed themselves there to escape whatever they'd seen. And they were all found dead by their own weapons. Even where they were, they killed themselves rather than face whatever was coming for 'em. So pay attention to this, Master Coster.
Caldras gestured at the circle of relaxed and rowdy sailors, drinking and throwing knives by the light of alchemical globes.
You sail a sea where shit like that happens, you can see the value of making your ship a happy home.
14.
Need a word, Captain Ravel.
A day had passed. The air was still warm and the sun still beat down with palpable force when not behind the clouds, but the seas were higher and the wind stiffer. The Red Messenger lacked the mast to knife deep into the turbulent waves without shuddering, and so the deck beneath Locke's feet became even less of a friend. Jabril, recovered from his close engagement with a wine bottle, and a pair of older sailors approached Locke as he stood by the starboard rail late in the afternoon, holding tight and trying to look casual. Locke recognized the older sailors as men who'd declared themselves unfit at the start of the voyage. Days of rest and large portions had done them good. Locke, in light of the ship's understrength complement, had recently authorized extra rations at every meal. The notion was popular.
What do you need, Jabril?
Cuts, Captain.
The bottom fell out of Locke's stomach. With heroic effort, he managed to look merely puzzled. What about them?
We've been down on the main deck, said one of the older sailors. Sleeping, mostly. Ain't seen no cats yet. Usually the little buggers are crawling around, doing tricks, looking to curl up and sleep on us.
I asked around, said Jabril. Nobody's seen even one. Not on the main deck, not up here, not on the orlop, not even in the bilges. You keeping them in your cabin?
No, said Locke, picturing with perfect clarity the sight of 8 cats, including Caldris Kitten, lounging contentedly in an empty armory shack above their private bay back at the Sword Marina. 8 cats sparring and yowling over bowls of cream and plates of cold chicken. 8 cats who were undoubtedly still lounging in that shack, right where he'd forgotten them, the night of the fateful assault on Windward Rock, 5 days and 700 miles behind them.
"Kittens," he said quickly. "I got a pack of kittens for this trip, Jabril. I reckoned a ship with a new name could do with new cats. And I can tell you they're a hell of a shy bunch. I myself haven't seen one since I dumped them on the orlop. I expect they're just getting used to us. We'll see them soon enough."
"Aye, sir." Locke was surprised at the relief visible on the faces of the 3 sailors.
"That's good to hear. Bad enough we got no women aboard until we get to the Ghost Winds. No cats would be plain awful."
"Couldn't tolerate no such offence," whispered one of the older sailors.
"We'll put out some meat every night," said Jabril. "We'll keep poking around the decks. I'll let you know soon as we find one."
"By all means," said Locke. Seasickness had nothing to do with his sudden urge to throw up over the side the moment they were gone. 15. On the evening of their 5th day out from Tal Varar, Caldris sat down for a private conversation in Locke's cabin with the door locked.
"We're doing well,"
the sailing master said, though Locke could see dark circles like bruises under his eyes. The old man had slept barely 4 hours a day since they'd reached the sea, unable to trust the wheel to Locke or Jean's care without supervision. He'd finally cultivated a fairly responsible master's mate, a man called Bald Mazuka, but even he was lacking in lore and could only be trained a little each day, with Caldris' attention so divided. They continued to be blessed by the behaviour of the rest of the crew. The men were still fresh with vigour for any sort of work following their escape from prison. A half-assed carpenter and a decent sailmaker had been found, and one of Jabril's friends had been optimistically voted quartermaster, in charge of counting and dividing plunder when it came. The infirm were gaining health with speed, and several had already joined watches. Lastly, the men no longer gathered to stare nervously across the ship's wake, looking for any hint of pursuit on the sea behind them. They seemed to think that they had evaded Stragos' retribution, and of course they could never be told that none would be forthcoming.
"This is your doing," said Locke, patting Caldris on the shoulder. He berated himself for not thinking beforehand of what a strain the voyage would put on the older man.
Mazuka would have to be shaped more quickly, and he and Jean would need to pick up whatever slack they could in their inept fashion.
"Even with a glassy sea and a fine breeze, there's no way in hell we'd have pulled this off so far without you."
"Strong weather coming, though," said Caldris. "Weather that will test us. Summer's end, like I said. Shit blows up that's like to knock you halfway round the world. Might spend days riding it out with bare poles, throwing up until there ain't a dry spot in the holds."
The sailing master sighed, then gave Locke a curious look.
"Speaking of holds, I heard the damnedest things the past day or two."
"Oh?" Locke tried to sound nonchalant.
"Ain't nobody seen a cat, not on any of the decks. Not a one has come up from wherever they are, not for anything, ale or milk or eggs or meat."
Sudden suspicion clouded his brow.
"There are cats down there, right?"
"Ah," said Locke. His sympathy for Caldris from a moment earlier remained like a weight on his heart. For once he found himself completely unwilling to lie, and he massaged his eyes with his fingers as he spoke.
No. The cats are all safe and sound in their shack in the Sword Marina, right where I left them. Sorry."
"You fucking jest," said Caldris in a flat, dead voice. "Come now. Don't bloody lie to me about this."
"I'm not." Locke spread his palms before him and shrugged. "I know you told me it was important. I had 100 things to do that night. I meant to fetch them honest."
"Important? I told you it was important. I told you it was fucking critical, is what I told you."
Caldris kept his voice at a whisper, but it was like the sound of water boiling against hot coals. Locke winced.
"You have imperiled our souls, Master Custer. Our very goddamned souls. We have no women and no cats and no proper captain, I remind you, and hard weather sits upon our course."
"Sorry, honestly."
"Honestly, indeed. I was a fool to send a landsucker to fetch cats. I should have sent cats to fetch me a landsucker. They wouldn't have disappointed me."
"Now, surely, when we reach Port Prodigal..."
"When is an audacious assumption, Leocanto? For long before then, the crew will cop wise to the fact that our cats are not merely shy, but imaginary. If they decide the cats have died off, they will just assume that we are cursed and abandon the ship when we touch land. If, however, the absence of smelly little bodies leads them to deduce that their fucking captain in fact brought none, they will hang you from a yardarm."
"Ouch."
"You think I jest? They will mutiny. If we see another sail on that horizon, in any direction, we must give chase. We must bring a fight. You know why? So we can take some of their bloody cats before it's too late."
Caldris sighed before continuing, and suddenly looked 10 years older.
"If it's a summer's end storm coming up on us," said Caldris, "it'll be moving north and west faster than we can sail. We'll have to pass through it, for we cannot outrun it by beating up to the east. It'll catch us still, and it'll only catch us tired. I'll do my damnedest, but you'd better pray in your cabin tonight for one thing."
"What's that?"
"Cats falling from the bloody sky."
16. Of course, no convenient rain of screeching felines was forthcoming that night, and when Locke made his first appearance on the quarterdeck the next morning, there was an ugly ghost-grey haze looming on the southern horizon like the shadow of an angry god. The bright medallion of the sun rising in the otherwise clear sky only made it seem more sinister. The starboard heel of the deck was yet more pronounced, and walking to anywhere on the larboard bow felt almost like going up a small hill. Waves slapped the hull and were pulverized to spray, filling the air with the smell and taste of salt. Jean was drilling a small group of sailors with swords and polearms at the ship's waist, and Locke nodded knowingly, as though he caught every nuance of their practice and approved. He toured the deck of the Red Messenger, greeting sailors by name, and tried to ignore the feeling that Caldris' gaze was burning holes in the back of his tunic.
"A fine morning to you, Captain,"
muttered the sailing master when Locke approached the wheel. Caldris looked ghoulish in the bright sunlight, his hair and beard washed whiter, his eyes sunken in deeper shadow, every line on his face newly re-etched by the hand of whatever god claimed him. "Did you sleep last night, Master Caldris?"
"I found myself strangely unable, Captain."
"You must rest sometime."
"Aye, and the ship must generally stay above the waters, or so I've heard it suggested."
Locke sighed, faced the bow, and studied the darkening southern sky. "A summer's end storm, I dare say. Been through enough of them in my time." He spoke loudly and casually.
"Soon enough you'll be in one more, Captain."
Locke spent the afternoon counting stores in the main hold with Mal as his scribe, marking little lines on a wax tablet. They ducked and weaved through a forest of salted meat in treated cloth sacks, hung from the beams in the hold and swaying steadily with the increasing motion of the ship. The hold was danker already from constant occupation by the crew. Those who had been inclined to sleep in the more open space beneath the forecastle had abandoned it as the promise of hard weather had loomed. Locke was certain he smelled piss. Someone was either too lazy or too frightened to crawl out and use the crap lines. That could get ugly. The whole sky was a cataract of haze grey by the fourth hour of the afternoon. Caldris slumped against the mast for a brief respite while Bald Mazooka and another sailor held the wheel, ordered sails trimmed and lanterns passed around from the storm lockers. Jean and Jabril led parties below decks to ensure that their cargo and equipment was all properly stowed. A weapons locker flying open or a barrel tumbling around in a rocking ship would send hapless sailors to meet the gods. After dinner, at Caldris' whispered insistence, Locke ordered those sailors who dipped into the ship's store of tobacco to smoke their last until further notice. Open flames would no longer be tolerated anywhere. Alchemical lanterns would provide all of their light, and they would use the hearthstone, or, more likely, take cold meals. Locke promised an extra half of a wine ration each night if that became necessary. A premature darkness had infused the sky by the time Locke and Jean could sit down for a quiet drink in the stern cabin. Locke closed the shutters over his stern windows, and the compartment seemed smaller than ever. Locke regarded the dubious comforts of this symbol of Ravel's authority. A padded hammock against the larboard bulkhead, a pair of stools, his sword and knives hung on the wall by storm clasps. Their table was a flat wooden board atop Locke's chest. Sad as it was princely compared to the glorified closets claimed by Jean and Caldris, or the way the men seemed to burrow in cargo and canvas matting on the main deck.
"I'm so sorry about the cats," said Locke.
"I could have remembered as well," said Jean.
Unspoken was the obvious statement that he trusted Locke enough not to feel that he needed to concern himself. Jean might be doing his best to stay polite, but guilt twisted in Locke's stomach more sharply for it. "No sharing this blame," said Locke, sipping his warm ale. "I'm the captain of the bloody ship."
"Don't be grandiose."
Jean scratched his belly, which had been reduced by his recent activity to a much less dramatic curve than it had once possessed.
"We'll think of something. Hell, if we spend a few days ploughing through a storm, the men won't have time to worry about anything except when and how hard to piss their britches."
Storm. Fine opportunity for one of us to misstep and look a fool in front of the men. More likely to be me than you."
"Quit brooding," Jean grinned. "Caldris knows what he's doing. He'll haul us through somehow."
There was a sudden heavy impact on the cabin door. Locke and Jean jumped up from their stools in unison, and Locke darted for his weapons. Jean shouted,
"What passes?"
"Costa!"
came a faint voice, followed by a feeble rattling, as though someone was trying and failing to work the latch. Jean pulled the door open just as Locke finished buckling on his sword belt. Caldris stood at the bottom of the companionway, clutching the door frame for support, swaying on his feet. The amber glow of Locke's cabin lamp revealed wretched details. Caldris' eyes were bloodshot and rolling upward, his mouth hung open, and his waxy skin was glazed with sweat.
"Help, Costa!"
he whispered, wheezing with a sound that was painful just to hear. Jean grabbed him and held him up.
"Damn," he muttered. "He's not just tired, Leo. Captain, he needs a bloody physica."
"Help, Costa,"
moaned the sailing master. He clawed at his left upper arm with his right hand, and then at his left breast. He squeezed his eyes shut and winced.
"Help me?"
Locke put a hand beneath Caldra's chin. The man's pulse was wild and erratic. "What do you mean, help me?"
"No."
Caldris grimaced with concentration, sucking in a harsh breath between each word.
"Help me, Costa."
"Lay him on the table," said Jean,
and together he and Locke pressed the old man down onto his back.
"Sweet gods," said Locke. "Is it the poison? I don't feel any different."
"Nor I," said Jean.
I think his heart is seizing up. I've seen it before.
Shit! If we can calm him down, maybe get him to drink something.
But Caldris moaned again, dug feebly at the left side of his chest with both hands, and shuddered. His hands fell limp. One long, strangled exhalation escaped from his throat, and Locke, in rising horror, felt frantically round the base of his neck with the fingers of both hands.
"His pulse is gone,"
Locke whispered. A soft rattle on the cabin roof, gentle at first, but quickly rising in tempo, told them that the first drops of rain were beginning to fall on the ship. Caldris' eyes, fixed on the ceiling, were lifeless as glass.
"Oh, shit," said Jean.